Good morning, Rod.
Good morning, Catherine.
You're on the road, as you often are. Lovely to talk. Let's begin. We're getting into reporting season, aren't we, with probably quite a few indicators coming through on how companies are dealing, are coping. You're looking at TNG Global.
Yes, I am. This is the horticultural producer and exporter that's been more familiar to people by their old name, Turners and Growers. And they've reported a quadrupling of profits on a 20% increase in revenues for the half year, with a big factor in that, a good jump in the revenue from apples. And actually one of the key factors, and this is quite fascinating, they acted with great foresight as they saw COVID and lockdown coming. So rather than relying on scheduled cargo services to get the apple harvest up to Europe and the United States, they chartered a ship, and it was an extra cost for them, and they'd not done such a thing before. But it allowed them to get all those apples up to market in a very timely fashion and without any of the headaches. And they think that that was one of the contributors towards this very good result. But behind that lies a lot of strategic development over recent years, because the company has been moving on quite a lot since BayWa, a German company big in the produce business, took majority ownership of TNG back in 2012.
So that's interesting. It's got an underlying strength, but it was on the ball strategically when it saw COVID looming and made sure it could get its product to market.
Yes, and indeed, Gareth Edgecombe, who is the chief executive, was one of the people I had a long interview with when I was doing a series on Newsroom of interviews with CEOs about how their companies were coping in lockdown. And it was very interesting how nimble TNG had been. It very seamlessly switched to remote working for lots of people, but also had to figure out in their pack houses how to do social distancing, same problem the kiwifruit and other industry had, but managed to get through all that and increase, obviously, a productivity setback as they put those procedures in place initially, but managed to build up from that. And so that actually had a very good season. But also in that conversation, he was saying that they'd got through the picking season well using the registered seasonal worker program. But there was a concern about how those people would then get back to their home countries afterwards. And, of course, that's been a lingering problem for some of those registered seasonal workers.
We know in horticulture, we know, for example, I think it was the kiwifruit season that had a bumper, didn't it? But as it was the apple revenues that were the driver for TNG. And as well as being able to get exports to market, did we see an increase in New Zealand purchasers buying fresh produce?
Yes, that was very much a factor during lockdown, that we were doing an awful lot more cooking at home and therefore buying an awful lot more of that fresh produce. And that had played to one of the three strategic themes that TNG has been pursuing about increasing the range of produce it's been offering and developing its relationship with growers and retailers to offer that broader range. And so lockdown worked well for them in that respect.
What then is the gist of the strategy, the three-pronged strategy?
The other two prongs are about working with, and this goes back a long time with Turners and Growers, about working with scientists to develop new plant varieties. That's a very slow process. So, for example, Envy, which is a new variety that's come out of Plant and Food, the Crown Research Institute, has taken about 15 years of commercialization to achieve its current scale and popularity. That's a good example of how that strategy has been accelerated and coming to gaining some real momentum in recent years. So now TNG grows apples of a number of varieties in 14 countries and sells them in more than 45. And the second big strategic initiative has been to expand channels into key markets overseas and developing its own teams on the ground there in the US, for example, or continental Europe and the UK, to build up that in-market capacity. And then get into emerging markets too, like China, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Japan. And again, that was something that came through in that long lockdown conversation with the CEO about how those people were still working well in those countries despite the virus constraints on them, which varied, of course, from country to country.
All right, well, let's look at the New Zealand Superannuation Fund. It is always looking for investments as its, you know, pile of assets, pile of money grows. It is buying into a company called Healthscope.
It is buying from Healthscope their New Zealand diagnostic, medical diagnostic business, which would be better known to people either by the lab test name in Auckland or various community laboratory operations around elsewhere around the country. And it's doing this jointly with the Ontario Teachers Pension Board. And together they're paying rather more than $550 million for the lab's business. No surprise about the Ontario Teachers. It's a very big pension fund. They're known here for buying Yellow Pages from Telecom at an extremely high price, $2.24 billion in 2007, a deal which then got very complicated under new ownership because the old yellow print format was quickly run over by internet-based services. But anyway, back to the this diagnostic business. People with a long memory, well, actually, you only need to go back 11 years, will remember how this all came about. The three Auckland District Health Boards were wanting to set up a competing supplier for these services in Auckland, and so signed an eight-year, $560 million contract with an Australian-based medical company to establish a whole new operation here in New Zealand, which became lab tests. And this then became subject to court challenges from Diagnostic Medlab, the incumbent of the previous contract, but Healthscope prevailed, but then got off to an incredibly rocky start in September 2009. There was a very poor service. There were all sorts of problems with tests of various kinds. The government got involved. The health boards got involved. But they persevered, and there was a change of chief executive very early on in those days. But the whole thing did settle down. And for me, the most interesting thing about the story is that the DHBs had pursued some quite big cost cutting. They were trying to take $15 million a year out of $70 million of contracts with Diagnostic Medlab. And yet, it turns out that the new operation that came in, which is now what the Superfund has bought, has been extremely profitable. So it made a net profit in the year to June 2019 of $34 million on revenue of $264 million. And it raises for me a whole bunch of questions as to how come it's so profitable. Surely the DHBs would be trying to get a sharper deal now that there's so much profits on the table. And if that's the case, how does the superannuation fund respond? It thinks it's bought a very profitable business. But you've got one arm of the government, i.e. the government paying through district health boards for these tests. But on the other hand, you've got another arm of government, the superannuation fund, profiting hugely from that. So I think it's a rather complex situation. It'll be quite fascinating to see how it works out, particularly as we know from that experience back in 2009, it's incredibly difficult to set up a competitor when you've got essentially a sole supplier or largely a sole supplier of such an important and complicated service.
Is there an obvious strategy behind investing in this kind of assets that we expect, whether it's pandemics or whether it is just the revolution and possibly personal revolution ahead of us in personal healthcare, that this is going to be a growth business?
It's all of that. It requires a great deal of technology, a great deal of organization, And there's obviously a very steadily developing need as populations age, medical technology improves, and then, of course, extraordinary circumstances come along like pandemics. So it's a very good business to be in, and it's a classic one for very long-term investors, such as the Superannuation Fund and the Ontario Teachers Pension Board, to invest in.
Okay, and just finally today, your third topic, BP, British Petroleum, has made a big commitment to net zero emissions. Now, this gets interesting, isn't it? The difference between emissions within your organisational structure and then emissions from your actual product. Is it going after the latter? Is it going to change its focus over time?
This was not entirely... Well, certainly the focus is changing. I'll come back to the detail of this, about how they are quite significantly shifting out of fossil fuel production over the next 10 years. They'll still be doing a lot of fossil fuels, but nowhere near as much. And amongst the major integrated oil companies, this is by far the biggest strategic shift that has been signaled. But quite how they're applying that term net zero emissions by 2050, I'm afraid I didn't get to the bottom of that. Because obviously, classically, you could look at just their operations and quite quickly get to net zero emissions. But if you're talking about the net zero emissions of their products, that would be a very big ask. It would mean they would be not in oil and gas by 2050. And I'm sorry I can't tell you, I wasn't able to drill down into that point. But what's going on, though, is that they've committed themselves to increase their annual investment in low-carbon technologies for industries by tenfold energy sources, boost renewable power generation 20-fold over this decade, but while shrinking their oil and gas production by 40% over that decade. So they are signaling really quite a significant shift away from oil and gas. And indeed, they on these results they've just announced, they took a nearly $17 billion US dollar loss because of writing down impairment of assets. This is a non-cash impairment based on their reduced long-term forecasts for oil prices. So you've got this fascinating thing going on in the world. There is a glut of oil, there's somewhat reduced demand, therefore prices are low, and therefore companies are beginning to think, A, how they still make a profit in oil and gas, but maybe it's time to move on. And we can be quite cynical about this because, in a sense, BP's been here before. Back in the late 1990s, it was touting itself as beyond petroleum, is how they like to describe their BP in their name, because they promised a big shift into clean energy, but they never seriously followed through. And indeed, their next big drama was they lost about $30 billion US dollars through fines and lost production as a result of their Deepwater Horizon platform disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. But this time around, there seems some solid strategy here, and investors have been supportive of this decision that they announced last week.
Thank you so much, Rod Oram, business commentator.